Neil Story, my guest this evening, as we discuss the Dracula secrets, Jack the Ripper, and the darkest sources of Bram Stoker. A different look at a very famous fictional character. Where did the inspiration come from? He's got some other great stories and insights tying this character, Dracula, to the Jack the Ripper tales and how they came to be. We'll continue talking about that. One of the more fascinating points I always thought, and boy, talk about a publicity stunt you couldn't ask for any better. In 1931 was a very important year in Dracula's history. It was the year that the Bela Lugosi classic was released. Well, it was also the same year that archaeologists were given permission to exhume the body of Vlad Tepish, Vlad the Impaler, who many people thought of as the real Dracula. And when they finally got in and cracked the crypt and opened up the ground, they were surprised to find that the grave was empty and there was bones of an animal there instead. And that's it. That is unbelievable PR. You couldn't ask for things better. Now, the real history of it more likely was that once Vlad Tepish was captured and beheaded, the Huns had taken his head in a jar of honey to preserve it to go back and prove that they had killed Vlad the Impaler, and that his body was taken by the priests and monks of that area and hidden so that no more further desecration could take place. But there's also a great conspiracy that he survived that and did not actually die. As a matter of fact, over the last few years, there's been a few new places that they believe they find that may actually be the real burial ground of Vlad Tepish, and that he may have lived many years past the time they thought of his actual death. That's just part of the stories and interesting history behind the Vlad Tepish angle of the story. When we come back, let's hear more about Drac and Jack, how they may be connected, with our guest, Neil Story, here on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest this evening, Neil Story, his book, The Dracula Secrets, Jack the Ripper, and the Darkest Sources of Bram Stoker. We've looked at some of the common misconceptions of this, and we've spoken to the man who's looked at all of the known manuscripts, all of the notes, letters, and so on that has been out there in historical reference and available to be viewed. He has seen them all, with no mention of people like Lady Bathory or Vlad Tepish, Vlad the Impaler, as the actual beginnings or genesis of the idea of where Dracula came from. There's an interesting connection between Drac and Jack, though, with Francis Tumblety, is that right?
You're absolutely right there.
And now, so people understand, Francis Tumblety was one of the possible suspects in the Jack the Ripper. Can you tell us a little bit about his story and where this connection comes as well?
Absolutely. Francis Tumblety was revealed in a letter by Inspector Littlechild of the Special Branch, the British Special Branch. Now, you have in Britain, you have a normal police, the Bobby's on the beat. You'll have Criminal Investigation Department, CID. So they're the specialists in hardened criminals and serious crime. But beyond that, the people that would have been dealing with anti-terrorist actions and dangers to the state, that special branch, and believe you me, that you don't mess with special branch in any way, shape, or form. These guys don't mess about. And Littlechild named Dr. T, it's a quack doctor title, Francis Tumblety, as I guess really the number one special branch suspect for Jack the Ripper. So that's the cold, hard fact about that. Francis Tumblety, he's Irish-born, and along with thousands of other good folks, times are hard in Ireland. You'd ended up with potato famines, sickness, epidemic disease, hard times. And so they came over to America. The very early life of Francis Tumblety, he's born somewhere near Dublin. The exact records sadly don't exist for that. But he came over to America, and he's there in New York. He's working in an area of, he's known to be dealing in pornography. He's peddling pornography to riverboats. Gets involved with a pharmacist come doctor, and it appears that he gets involved with some pretty murky business, particularly procuring abortions. And it's thought that through watching and learning, rather than any real or serious medical study in a recognized training establishment for doctors, he becomes an abortionist too. He develops a patent pimple banisher with time. That's where he makes his serious money. And if any of you get hold of a copy of Harper's from the time of the American Civil War, you will normally see an advert on back pages for Tumblety's pimple banisher. And that's Francis Tumblety. That's how he makes his money. He makes a lot of it. He's also very much a self-publicist. At the time of the Civil War, he's seen on the streets, in areas where there are military towns, in a faux uniform, something that looks official, not quite the usual run of the armies at the time. He's in, on the Union rather than Confederate side. He allies himself with the general staff. He claims, and may well have delivered treatments to some of the senior staff there, but he probably over-eggs what he actually does. He's even involved at one point, and probably quite happy to be involved, in the conspiracy to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. And he is arrested and imprisoned because of that. It's probably due to mistaken identity. He ends up inside. He ends up inside as well for being part of what they called it was a yellow fever scam, whereby it was alleged that one army was sending trunks filled with soiled bedclothes to another army's base. So when they were opened, these trunks, it would spread yellow fever. So he gets in trouble for that. So he's used to fleeing from place to place. They're the most infamous cases he's involved with. There's people that are made ill through his abortion, so he has to get away. He also over-eggs his pimple banisher and cures, and he lists in his advertising all the people he's helped treat sexual diseases and facial blemishes. Blemishes, and a lot of people don't really want their name associated as an endorsement for, you know, some disfiguring ailment that they've had. So they threaten to sue him, and then he flees across the border. He's a master of disguise. He's a big, tall guy, about 6 foot tall. But he's able to disguise himself as a Native American, and he flees across borders, dyes his skin, wears clothes akin to a Native American. He goes to Canada. He gets thrown out of Montreal, but he wears a medal on his uniform, supposedly from the grateful people of Montreal. He travels in Europe, setting up his business in the capitals. He says that he's gone to France and he's treated people of nobility there, and he's got awards, got the Légion d'honneur for his treatment, and he's also got involved with the Prussian forces. There's the infamous picture of him on the, he would even write his own little pamphlet biographies to defend his actions, an infamous picture of him in his faux uniform wearing a German spiked helmet, a Pickelhalber, and he's got this big fancy moustache. So he's larger than life. But for those that know him socially, he has a vociferous hatred of women. It is said that he claimed to have contracted a sexual disease from his wife, although even the fact that was he married or not isn't clear. But this woman he considered his wife gave him an injury, in quotes, an injury that no longer made him a man. And it's quite possible that he was homosexual in his proclivities from that time onwards. Although whether it was a sexual relationship is another thing. Man love was a very different thing to the Victorians, but he's certainly known to associate with those who were very effete, the Bohemians. He's known to associate with people that have subsequently been revealed as having full sexual homosexual relationships. So he's certainly on that scene. And in the letters that I discovered between him and Thomas Henry Hall Caine, he always signed it yours affectionately, or affectionately yours, FTMD. So it's quite possible he was close to his male friends, to say the least. And among them was Thomas Henry Hall Caine. Quite rightly, you probably haven't heard of him. Most of the world have forgotten Thomas Henry Hall Caine. But he was the first man to sell 1 million copies of his books in the English language. The trouble is, his books are love triangles, very much in the old Victorian ways, that they've got Christian and moral messages in them, so they don't endure like his contemporaries, like Robert Louis Stevenson or Thomas Hardy, for example. He just doesn't endure. And so people have forgotten him. But in his day, he was quite a force to be reckoned with. As Thomas Henry Hall Caine was a young man, when he was a young man progressing and starting his journey to become a great author, he made contact with Tumblety. It seems that they were in the same area at the same time. They would have probably shared the same newspaper offices. It was called the Liverpool Lantern on Warrington Chambers, Castle Street, Liverpool, in England. Hall Caine was a theatre critic that worked for the paper and a number of other Liverpool newspapers, and it is known that Tumblety had set up an office for his patent medicines in Liverpool and his other back street abortion business as well, and he encountered this impressionable young Hall Caine. And so there's the connection. Hall Caine and Tumblety were quite probably lovers. We can't prove that. But what we do know, beyond a doubt, the content of the letters is clear. Their relationship was very close. And Hall Caine was subject to... He was coerced quite often. You can see in these letters. You know, Tumblety would write very strongly and almost demand... And in fact, he did demand that Hall Caine do certain things to sell the patent medicines, promote his business, and use Hall Caine's connections. Hall Caine already had a connection through elections and promotions in elections with William Gladstone, who became one of our prime ministers. So
he was quite the press release mogul of the time. I mean, trying to use every access he could to promote whatever business or transaction he was behind.
You're absolutely right. Self-publicity, publicity for his business, and he will use people. And if he feels that, you know, he can use them strongly to his advantage, and he wasn't averse to coerce them, you know. And I believe that there was a sexual element to their relationships that
Tumblety. And we've got about. We've got about 4 minutes left in the segment. Yeah, in the segment, you know, about 4 minutes left. But how does Tumblety kind of cross over into the Dracula inspiration?
Well, what happens here is that Hall Caine went to the Lyceum Theatre in London. He got a free ticket from Henry Irving, and he was shown to his box by the stage manager, the acting manager there, another man that adored Henry Irving. Of course, it was Bram Stoker. And when two men like that meet, it's either going to be sparks or they'll hate one another, or they'll become friends for life. So Hall Caine and Bram became very, very close friends. They even wrote together. They stayed with one another. They traveled together. And of course, Tumblety was gone by that time. He was in the States, but he was still visiting London. And it's every chance there was an encounter, at least a sighting, because when Bram creates Dracula, well, there's a certain incident near Piccadilly, a known cruising area for homosexual encounters. And there, with Hall Caine, I think he spotted Tumblety. And it's certainly where Jonathan Harker spots Dracula in Britain for the very first time.
These characters, that as they would evolve, and I know we talked about the fact of who it was most likely not brought up, you know, who inspired these characters and where he might be getting some of these ideas through this. How does his tie-in, where do you find the notes that there's definitely an inspiration behind the Jack the Ripper murders as part of the background and backdrop of the story, as opposed to any of the other characters we've always been led to believe?
This is almost hidden in plain sight, or at least if you're bilingual in English and Icelandic. Because in the early 1900s, the first foreign language edition of Dracula was published in Icelandic. And the foreword for that book was it was rewritten by Bram. And my friend Richard Dolby discovered this was different. He knew an Icelandic lady, a neighbor actually, and asked her to roughly translate it, and he found that it indicated Jack the Ripper. We've had it retranslated from my book to make sure it's absolutely clear. And Bram Stoker, in the first foreign language edition of Dracula, clearly states that he has based his story, at least in part, on the climate of fear and the crimes of Jack the Ripper in 1888. And let's face it, Bram was in London, and he was also around the country on tour with the Lyceum at the time of those murders. It was also when Richard Mansfield was on the stage at the very same theatre, the Lyceum Theatre, where Bram was the acting manager, Richard Mansfield, the great American actor, that was the first to dramatize Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for the stage anywhere in the world. And his portrayal of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was so scary, so realistic, that it was believed at that time that it was influencing the murderer known as the Whitechapel Murderer, also known as Jack the Ripper.
You hear this, man, there sounds like there's a whole new conspiracy swirling underneath this, right? Because Jack the Ripper liked to taunt. He would write these letters, reportedly, to try to get the police involved. He would send items to let them know that he was who he said he was. If Bram Stoker could be put in the same place, and he's writing this book and using this inspiration, I'm surprised nobody's glommed onto the idea that maybe Bram Stoker was involved in these murders in some way, and this was his way of admitting to it without admitting to it.
Well, you see, if Bram was involved in a close male relationship with Hall Caine, there's every chance that Tumblety would be aware of this. I think that Tumblety would have guessed it at the Beefsteak Club, which was where they would go and dine after performances at the Lyceum Theatre. He would be an ideal guest. Even if it's just to hear his bluster and bravado, he would be the ideal guest there. And I bet they met. I bet they did. And I think on those long nights that Hall Caine and Bram were together, they shared stories, dark stories. And I believe that Bram, through Hall Caine, realized that this, you know, that this is the identity, as he thought, of Jack the Ripper. And it is Hall Caine. It is through Hall Caine, it's Tumblety.
Fascinating.
It's absolutely chilling.
And again, this isn't just left to conjecture or you're putting together pieces of a puzzle that don't exist. You find in the Icelandic version of the book that he specifically states that the idea for this, the history of this, all comes from the sense of fear and the killings that were taking place in Whitechapel at that time. We have to take a break. Neil Story, our guest this evening. If you like stories like this and you like the strange and supernatural, I encourage you to join me Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight Central Time on my show, Darkness Radio. You can find more information about that at darknessradio.com. You could stream our show live Monday through Friday. You'll find our free archives there. And then right after the show airs live, keep listening, because Coast to Coast takes over with George Norrie. We'll be back with more right here on the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to the show. First of all, I want to thank all of the amazing Coast listeners. George Nori made the announcement the other day. I became a grandfather for the first time. My little granddaughter Stella was born and is home healthy and happy, everything going great. But once he mentioned that, I received a ton of emails from listeners congratulating me. And I just wanted to reach out and let you know I do appreciate it. And although I may not be able to answer every one of the emails, thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for all the good thoughts and intentions and prayers for my family and for my new granddaughter. She is amazing and such a blessed part of my life. Listen, if you've missed tonight's show, you've missed parts of it, you just came into it, you're hearing Jack the Ripper, Dracula, and you're kicking yourself. You're wishing you would have heard the entire show. Well, fear not, faithful listeners, because it's very easy to catch up on what you've missed. You can do that by going to coasttocoastam.com and become an insider. It's a one-year subscription, breaks down to only 15 cents a day. You'll be able to hear this show and all of the episodes I've been a co-host on and all of the great topics for myself, the other co-hosts, and, of course, the master himself, George Nori. They're all on the site, 5 years of the past archives, thousands of shows, great topics, inside and out for you to investigate and listen to on your leisure. There's also an app so that you can take it with you on the road and anywhere you go. There are live chats with George Nori and some of the great guests you hear on the show. So go check that out. Become a Coast Insider and find out why we are the best in overnight talk radio. And while you're there, make sure you check out George's TV show, Beyond Belief. There's a link and information right there. And if you didn't know about it, that's right. Things that you love to hear about here on Coast to Coast AM with the Theater of the Mind, he takes you to the next level on Beyond Belief. So go check out beyondbelief.com for more with George Nori. And speaking of more, we'll be back with more Neil Story and more of the link between Dracula and Jack the Ripper. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I will be back with you May 7th and 8th, and I hope that you'll join us. May 7th, Dark Waters joins me to talk about dogmen, Rougarou, and other creatures of the South, vampire stories, ghosts, and more. You'll make sure to tune in for that. I promise you, he is a fantastic speaker, great storyteller as well. You will not want to miss that. Then, when I'm back on May 8th, we'll be discussing Atlantis in the Caribbean. That's right. There may be proof that Atlantis existed and they found the spot for it. We'll also be talking about the legend of King Arthur and the search for his tomb. We'll talk about all of that on the best in overnight talk radio, Coast to Coast AM. Tonight, my guest is Neil Story. We've been discussing his book, The Dracula Secrets, Jack the Ripper, and the Darkest Sources of Bram Stoker. When you were putting this book together, were you surprised by the amount of information that was still available after 100 years of this being out there? Was it kind of mind-blowing to find all of this intricate information and letters and notes and things like that that people seem to have overlooked all this time?
Well, it really was, but I have to say it was a slow drip feed of revelation and discovery over a period of about 25 years of love of subject and fascination in the story and the creation of Dracula by Bram. For so many years, so many books had been produced where there was speculation about the themes that Bram was writing about in the book and what it meant, even who some of the characters in it were based on. And as a historian, it fascinated me to try and find out, and somebody who loved the book, where does it really come from? Can we strip this back? Let's get back. Are the manuscript notes out there? The Hall Caine archive is on the Isle of Man, and it had been in the archives for a very, very long while, but due to certain family sensitivities, it had not been released. And when it was, it took about 10 years for them to sort it, and every year that I'd, over about 10 years from the moment I heard it existed, I had no idea what would be in that archive. I had an idea that there were letters from Francis Tumblety, that's for sure. I'd worked out the connection with Bram, that I knew, that Hall Caine knew Bram, Hall Caine knew Tumblety. So there might be something. A couple of letters were used in a biography of Hall Caine, a couple of letters from Turnbull Tea, and so I thought, well, there might be more. I had no dream that when I went over to the Isle of Man and was able to access the full archive for the very first time, I think I was the first historian ever to open it, and have a look for the Turnbull Tea connection. I wasn't expecting over 30. And when we got 30 plus notes, plus telegrams to Hall Caine, that was amazing. And then to see and it's a huge correspondence between Hall Caine and Stoker. I had no idea that Stoker and Hall Caine were so intimately involved with each other. Stoker acted as Hall Caine's kind of a manager. They would stay together. They would write together. Some people have talked about the second hand that you will see on the manuscript for Dracula. Oh, and they say, oh, Bram Stoker didn't write it all. Well, he did. And I found a letter from Hall Caine to his wife stating that when they were staying in Edinburgh, oh, it's been a very long day. They were sharing rooms together. And what had happened, Bram had been dictating all day. And Hall Caine was absolutely worn out. He was a bit of a hypochondriac too, by the way, was Hall Caine. I'm absolutely worn out with all this writing. And yeah, he's being dictated to by Bram. And it would work vice versa as well. You'll see Bram's rather crabby hand on some of his manuscripts too. So it was an incredible journey. And then with the publication of the notes for Dracula, I was able to follow up, really, for the first time, with a really in-depth UK investigation of, you know, where are these sources? What do they contain? For example, in the notes for Dracula that Bram has, there are two photographs. Now, and they are described in the catalogue, I believe, of that, that they were two pictures of Whitby Abbey. Well, that was an assumption that the cataloguer had made. They're, in fact, not of Whitby Abbey at all. It's of a nearby... Whitby is in North Yorkshire in Great Britain, and a short distance from there is York, and that's kind of the centre there. And the pictures that you will see in the notebooks are actually the ruins of St. Mary's Abbey Church in York. But that doesn't mean that Bram didn't visit Whitby Abbey. Of course he did. It's in the notes. He visited the churchyard up there on the cliff edge in Whitby. Whitby is key to the Dracula story. We knew that, but there's more detail that I was able to find there. I even found a copy of exactly the same guidebook, the Horn's Guide to Whitby in North Yorkshire, that Bram Stoker used. We know he used that one. We even know the edition, because it's all in his notes. So when you actually make his notes work for you, you can trace the sources of Bram Stoker very effectively and very accurately.
Let me ask you, Neil, if you think that Bram may have been on to Turnbull Tea being the real Ripper, why do you think that Turnbull Tea or Hall Caine never came forward with that information? Because that would have only, I would guess, that would have only helped further both of them, or certainly Bram Stoker as having to happen to help crack the case wide open. That would have etched him into the minds and hearts of the world even more so than his book would have.
Well, indeed so. But we have to consider the times. And from a young man at university, Bram Stoker had spoken in favor of man love. He was a very big fan of Walt Whitman, and particularly his book Leaves of Grass, in which the term man love is used. And he actually got in contact with Whitman, and when the Lyceum Company was on tour, he even went to see Walt Whitman. And indeed, when Walt passed away, he left some of his archive to Bram, and a lot of people don't know that. Now, the notion of what man love entailed in the Victorian age could mean a very close friendship. I am sure that many of us will remember when we were young, there used to be maiden aunts or ladies who would live together. And for some of us, there would be no connotation of it being a lesbian relationship. So women could live together, men living together, in Victorian standards, that was not something people were always comfortable with. Although, you must remember, one of the most famous male-male relationships in literature talks of two men spending an awful lot of time together in a small apartment. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. And there's no mention of that being a homosexual relationship. Watson is married. But then again, so was Oscar Wilde. So it's a twist. It's a dangerous twist to look too deeply into it, because we must not enforce our modern views and standards upon that. But that said, and with that in mind, you've got to remember Tumblety would not be averse to coming out with something quite dramatic to make a statement verbally. And it might well have inspired Hall Caine and Stoker. He may have even confessed to have been Jack the Ripper to them. But in the same vein, he would make these statements to really boost himself up. But also, he would couch that in the same situation by saying, but you can't say anything because I know about you. And he has enough of a devious mechanism within him and enough of a knowledge of publicity that Tumblety could put it out there that in fact there is a full-blown homosexual relationship between Hall Caine and Bram Stoker. It could ruin both of their lives, their careers. Both Hall Caine and Bram Stoker had families. So what do you do? Armed with, pregnant with this knowledge, weighted within you, what do you do with it? You can't go to the authorities because in those days it was a criminal offense. Make no mistake about it, and you would be shunned and shamed in society. So what do you do?
But it would seem, though, the intelligence of those two men, they could easily deflect and say, look, he's just trying to take the heat off of him. He's admitted to us that he was Jack the Ripper, that he was the killer, and we could put him in those areas at that time. And obviously now he's trying to get, you know, us to, you know, trying to discredit us so that the story does not seem as reliable. Do you really think people would have glommed onto more of the homosexuality of Bram Stoker and Hall over who the killer was?
Well, the point is that to make an accusation, you need to have proof. What proof do they have? The bluster and bravado of a man who is known to be a self-serving publicist. That's what Tumblety could easily break that. Bravado. And he could get away with that. And then he would flee. He's not a public figure in the same way that Bram and Hall Caine were. These are men of influence, of respect, men of literature.
Did Tumblety outlive the both of them?
He outlived Bram. Hall Caine outlived all of them. Hall Caine actually died in 1931. So he would have taken quite a bit to the grave with him, I think. But we must remember that it wasn't just in Dracula. In a very strange book called The Last Confession, it's buried into a strange three-volume story. Two of the volumes are quite amusing. And then in the center, this is by Hall Caine, in the center of this book called The Last Confession, and it talks of a murderer stalking the streets, dragging people up alleyways and cutting the throats. And this is the confession on the bed of a murderer with blood on his hands, seeing the faces of his victims, seeking a confessor. And it does seem to me that, not necessarily hearing it on the deathbed, I don't think that's the case, but being armed with this knowledge, how would somebody receiving that confession feel? And that's certainly what Hall Caine writes about in The Last Confession. For Bram Stoker, all of his books, we mustn't forget, he's written quite a volume of books, quite a canon of works beyond and before Dracula. And he loved codes, he loved riddles. I mean, for example, there was an explorer by the name of Richard Burton. Not to be confused with Richard Burton, the actor. This guy, Richard Burton, the explorer, he's an Orientalist. He is one of the inspirations for the character Dracula. And it is recorded, there's an obscure little chapter in the biography of Irving that was published after the death of Burton. But it states that in the Beefsteak Club, that Burton confessed to, in a foreign country, committing a murder. That was under the circumstances that he went around the country in disguise, and he was recognized by somebody of a particular faith that were very angry in their worship and would not want him intruding into their inner sanctums of worship. And so, to save his own life, Burton had got this man on his own and killed him. So that's in there. Could he have been so overt about Tumblety? I don't think so, because Tumblety was still alive. So embedded in his books, Stoker would put the knowledge that he had in there. And that's, in some ways, what you could even call the code of Dracula. Because, for instance, one of the pivotal points that I make in my book as far as that code goes is Chicksand Street. It's in the East End of London. It's just off Brick Lane. And the interesting thing is, Chicksand Street is where one of the boxes of earth from Transylvania, this is where Dracula, it's his hideout. It's where he holes up. And it's thought that the Ripper certainly had somewhere in the East End of London where he stayed. And if you look at the maps of the time, and even the police patrol map that was published for the time of the Jack the Ripper murders, it's quite simple. If you put a compass point on Chicksand Street and you draw a very simple circle around for around about the square mile, all of the Jack the Ripper murders fall within that circle. So Chicksand Street, one of the centres of one of the streets at the centre of the Ripper crimes, and it's where Bram Stoker sends the box of common earth to become a base for Dracula to seek his victim.
Fascinating. Great stuff. Neil Story, our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. When we return after the top of the hour break, we'll open up phone lines. If you have questions regarding the topics of Dracula and Jack the Ripper for our guest, you're welcome to call in and be a part of the show with us. We'll also talk with our guest about Victorian ghost stories, some of the great ghost stories that take place all throughout England, some of the stories he's familiar with, and has he had his own personal experiences. You can look forward to that and so much more. So keep tuned in with us. We've got that coming. And please, during the break, go check out darknessradio.com, and you'll be able to find out more information about me and my radio show, Darkness Radio, which can be heard Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight Central Time, also on iHeartRadio. And if you keep streaming our show right after it's over, George Norrie and Coast to Coast continues your journey into the strange and unknown. That's 5 nights a week with Darkness Radio, 7 nights a week with Coast to Coast AM, and you can hear all of that on our website. We'll also find all of our free archives and links to the upcoming events where you can meet me and my co-host and producer Tim Dennis, as we'll be traversing the United States and the world this year. We'd love for you to come on out and join us. Stay tuned. We've got so much more coming your way. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.